Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. Coming up on our program today, vaccine timeline confusion.
Why is the Prime Minister refusing to reveal key information to Canadians who need to know about the availability and distribution of a COVID-19 vaccine?
So Ontario gives a detailed vaccine timeline today, but the federal government won't confirm it. When will vaccines arrive for you? Who will get it? Is there a rollout plan? We talk about that, and then border controls. New numbers from the Canadian Border Agency reveals that 6.5 million crossings were granted since the end of March. 81% of those trips did not require a quarantine. Mostly essential workers, of course. Should there have been better tracking for contact tracing? Health MPs are joining us in a minute to debate all those issues. Plus, Canada under cyber attack. Are Canada's electricity plants, elections, and businesses under attack from China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea? According to the new report from Canada's cyber espionage agency, the answer is yes. So what should Canada do? We'll speak to the head of Canada's Center for Cybersecurity about the new report in a few seconds. Then, even with vaccines on the horizon, are we staring down the barrel of a lockdown, as Premier Doug Ford said today? We will weigh in on the press gallery. We got a special guest on that, a medical perspective, so you get the facts on that. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. So there was some vaccine hope today, which is great. But there's also a lot of vaccine confusion, which is not so great. Ontario today revealed that it will receive its first doses of vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna in the early part of 2021. Check this out.
We are expecting that we will receive shipments from both Pfizer and Moderna. There are significant issues with respect to the Pfizer vaccine in particular. It needs to be stored at minus 75 degrees Celsius and Moderna minus 20. The doses for Canada, we expect to receive 4 million doses between January and March of the Pfizer vaccine, 2 million for Moderna, of which we anticipate that we will receive 1,600,000 of Pfizer and 800,000 of Moderna. People do have to be received two doses 21 days apart. This is a major logistical challenge, but we have an entire group within the Ministry of Health right now that are planning for that.
Okay, that's pretty specific. The doses for Canada, the doses for Ontario, the two doses, the storage issues, the logistical challenge. So that is the Ontario Minister of Health, Christine Elliott, giving timelines and specifics about when you could get a vaccine. So, of course, that prompted MPs in question period in Ottawa to ask the federal health minister the same questions, but she refused to confirm those details. What happened in question today? Well, check this out.
In terms of distribution, we will work out with provinces and territories as we have with other things like personal protective equipment, rapid tests, a ratio or sharing approach that will work to ensure that all Canadians have access to viable and safe vaccines.
Okay, so no details there. Why isn't there a level of detail from the federal government on the vaccine rollout when the provinces are clearly giving that? Let's bring in MPs to discuss all that. Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Health, Darren Fisher, joins us. Conservative health critic Michelle Rempel-Garner joins us. And NDP health critic Don Davies is also here. Great to have all of you here. I think we've got Mr. Fisher.
Just came in.
I think we got him. Ms. Fisher, let me just start with you. Minister Elliott in Ontario gave a detailed timeline of early vaccine procurement today. She said Ontario is expecting 1.6 million doses from Pfizer, 800,000 from Moderna. Why can't the federal government confirm those numbers? And if so, can you give us any more details?
Well, we don't. First of all, thank you very much for having me. We don't have an approved vaccine yet. We do have lots of contracts with lots of potential vaccine manufacturers and developers. And the, you know, things look very good. We are very optimistic that we will have something, in the early part, hopefully early to mid part of 2021. However, it's very difficult to, you know, you don't want politicians doing the rollout. You want science and evidence-based rollouts. And we are doing the work and we are looking at every possibility for a successful rollout to ensure that we can get Canadians vaccinated.
But sir, I'm just trying to figure this out, because you're supposed to be coordinating with the provinces on the vaccines, because the federal government, as the federal government, is the ones that procuring it. So I'm just going to ask you again. Ontario gave a detailed analysis, 4 million. We all know, and Christine Elliott was clear as well, this is subject to the approval from Health Canada. But once it's approved, once there's the green light, how can the province of Ontario give specific numbers and the federal government can't? Why is there a disconnect?
Well, again, like the minister said this afternoon, we'll continue to work with the provinces, territories to ensure that they have what they need when they need it, as soon as it becomes available. And, you know, we've worked with them well from the start. And that I don't see that relationship changing. I see that relationship growing. We'll take lots of advice from NACI and some of the science and evidence-based groups out there that would help us develop a rollout that will ensure, right, like I say, the Canadians get the vaccines that they need when they become available. And that rollout may be different depending on the vaccine that is approved first.
I get it. So I'm going to press, before I go to the opposition, I just have to press one last time. Is Christine Elliott wrong then? Or is that what the federal government's saying? You don't stand by her numbers. We should not believe the health minister of Ontario?
I'm not aware of where she got her numbers. I'm not sure what provinces have for possible numbers that might come forward, depending on which contract yields a successful and approved by Health Canada that is safe for Canadians vaccine.
You don't know where the Minister of Health got fundamental numbers. That, to be honest, that's a bit stunning. I'm going to go to Michelle Rempel, the government. To be fair to the government, they have a lot of vaccines and they're not approved yet. I totally appreciate that. But there seems to be a wild disconnect between what Ontario is saying and what the federal government. What does that tell you, Michelle Rempel?
Oh, that's stunning. I mean, this guy is paid to have this information for Canadians, and he can't give it to you on his show. And it just goes to show how behind the federal government has been in these issues. Let's talk about the influenza vaccine this year. The federal government did not procure enough doses for a basic vaccine that we get every year. In fact, Ontarians have not had full access to influenza vaccines. So now we're talking about a COVID vaccine that, as Minister Elliott mentioned, has distribution challenges. The federal government has a role to play in giving direction to their bureaucrats. That's the job of ministers. If we don't need them, then my colleague needs to say that he doesn't need a job. But their job is to give direction to bureaucrats and say, we need a plan. We need a plan to distribute these vaccines. And then they need to be transparent to Canadians about this so that epidemiologists, immunologists can validate whether or not it is viable. And that also we can have a discussion about the ethics of who gets the vaccine and in what order. This is information that should be available to the Canadian public well in advance of any vaccine being distributed across the country, so that we can educate Canadians about that and we can assure Canadians that there is a sound plan. This week, the federal government was all over the map on this. They wouldn't answer questions about a distribution plan. Then they started talking about potentially using the Canadian Armed Forces, deploying them on the vaccine, not taking into consideration things like Minister Elliott talked about with regard to some of the temperature storage issues that have been encountered. It's highly concerning. So we will continue to press the government for this plan, and it's incumbent upon them to do their jobs and present that to the Canadian public in a transparent and timely manner.
Let me go over to Don Davies. Don Davies, just two things. I'll go back to Mr. Fisher about if there's going to be a plan just on the transparency side. I know, listen, we all appreciate nothing's been approved yet. But Mr. Davies, what do you make of the fact that Ontario seems to have a lot of details and the federal government saying we don't know where she got those details?
Well, it's completely puzzling. And, you know, those were very specific numbers and manufacturers that the Ontario Health Minister was talking about today. She said 4 million doses from Pfizer, 2 million from Moderna. She even specified how many doses of those would go to Ontario and how many to the rest of the country. That didn't sound like she's making things up. So it leads to a fundamental question about what's going on? Why are we in Parliament hearing from a provincial health minister what the national reception of COVID vaccines are going to be and in what numbers and how they'll be distributed? I have to say that other than bland assurances and vague generalities, that's all I've heard from the Minister of Health and from this government for months and months and months. And look, there is no issue more important to Canadians right now, none, than a vaccine. It's what they are depending on to get their health back protected. It's what they're counting on to get our economy back to some sense of normalcy. And yet, as was pointed out, you know, we still haven't had a plan about where we're getting these vaccines, how they're going to be distributed, who's distributing them. I met with pharmacists on the weekend, and they've been telling me they've not been consulted by this government. And one would think that the pharmacies of this country would be key players in terms of inoculating the millions of Canadians that are going to happen when a vaccine comes. So I'm sorry, but Mr. Fisher's answers are not good enough.
Well, let me go back to you, Mr. Fisher. Opposition, a bit surprised, or more than a bit surprised, by the confusion. Just a straight answer. Will the federal government reveal a rollout plan, a distribution plan? When, how many, who gets it? All those fundamental things. How will it be distributed? When will that plan be rolled out? Because, again, according to Ontario, we're months away from this happening.
Vaccine is accepted and approved by Health Canada and is seen as being safe and effective for Canadians, the rollout will be made public.
That's too late. Well,
so every
Well, that's too late. I mean,
why the delay? Why not just tell us the plan to roll it out?
Yeah. So the plan is we're looking at every opportunity. We must make sure that we have every stone turned to ensure that we have the best possible access, the prioritizing. Everything has to be absolutely in place.
But cliches aren't going to cut it. We need to have a plan, and it needs to be developed now. I mean, if Ontario is talking about rolling this out in January, it's a few short weeks away. We should be scrutinizing the details of this. And if it's in the best interest of the Canadian public now, we should be educating the Canadian public now. We should be talking to pharmacists, the military, whoever, now. And like, this is dangerous. I can't even believe what I'm hearing.
Mr. Davies, I want you to weigh in.
Well, I think this would really help if we had transparency. And I have to say, you know, we're 9 months into this this crisis, really, and there's been just a shocking lack of transparency. Even if you dig into the numbers a bit, Evan, Prime Minister Trudeau has said that he negotiated 20 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine. That's what he said. And we know it's a double vaccine. You need 10 and 10 million. Yet Ontario Health Minister Elliott today said that we're getting 4 million doses between January and March of this year. So where's the other 16 million doses? We've been hearing reports that we're not actually getting the Pfizer vaccine until months after the U.S. and the U.K. gets it. So this is why, you know, the Liberal government refused to release any of the contracts. And by the way, Brazil just released almost the entire AstraZeneca contract. Other countries are releasing them. Is it because this allows the Prime Minister and Liberals to just keep claiming they've got all these deals, but we don't know when the vaccines will be distributed or whether it's a set number of doses or whether it's up to a certain number of doses? Never mind rollout. And I just want to say quickly, by now we know what the distribution protocol should be. We know it should be going to healthcare, frontline healthcare workers, vulnerable populations, seniors, etc. Why is that a state secret? Why is that not rolled out by now, pending the actual release of the vaccine?
I'm sure.
No reason that should be.
I'm sure it will follow the H1N1. But just, I'm going to go back to Mr. Fisher to answer this, but I want to get Michelle Rempel on the record, because we had the procurement minister, Anita Anand, on this program. And she had said, and by the way, Pfizer has also said, they're worried about a motion that you backed that could put risk making confidential contractual information on vaccines, and that could jeopardize getting access to vaccines. When you hear from the head of Pfizer and you hear from the government that this motion might actually jeopardize the speed at which we get a vaccine because they're concerned about confidential contractual information and IP, are you concerned about that? Are you willing to moderate that motion?
to me or to Mr. Fisher?
No, to you, Michelle Rempel.
Well, we've already expressed that we've invited the law clerk to committee to talk about redactions, but let's go back to the issue that we've just spent 10 minutes debating. We have no transparency from this government on any of their plans. So Canadians deserve to have this information. And I don't buy into the hyperbole that the procurement minister, who has been extremely opaque, dangerously opaque, in procurement of things like personal protection equipment, vaccines, rapid tests, that somehow parliamentary scrutiny is not needed in this situation. I am fully confident.
Well, to be fair, it was also, I also will get Mr. Fisher on that. But the CEO of Pfizer also expressed that.
The minister is right. We need transparency. Enough is enough.
Mr. Fisher, there's real concern. Go ahead, Mr. Fisher.
I heard you and Michelle talking at the same time. I didn't hear a question in there.
Okay, well, let me ask you a question.
It's important to know that when we pass our motion, it specifically allows redaction for contractual negotiations. So that is a ground upon which the government is entitled to withhold information from the contract. So that's why the concern of the head of Pfizer and Minister Anand is simply baseless, because they do have the ability to redact anything that would jeopardize their contractual relations. So it's a non-starter.
Okay, Mr. Fisher, I'm just going to ask you one last time. The opposition is asking some pretty basic questions. I think the public. Ontario has released details about distribution. When this is happening, we could be weeks away. Can you give us any indication if the government has prepared a plan? If so, have you consulted with the pharmacies? Have you solved the storage issue? Can you give us any details as to when, who, and how this vaccine is going to be distributed on a federal level, sir?
The advanced guidelines, there's some guidelines were given by the National Advisory Committee on Immunization, and they have proposed some advanced guidelines on a rollout. And that is some of the things that we will be looking at. We have mentioned that we will consider utilizing the military if needed. The military have come in very handy at long-term care facilities. We will look at every option to ensure that when we get vaccines that are ready for distribution and approved by Health Canada, it's not too late to wait until now.
This is crazy and irresponsible. We should be looking at this now. It should be public now.
I just want to hear Mr. Fisher. Hang on. Go ahead, Mr. Fisher. Just finish that.
So again, the advanced guidance from the National Advisory Committee on Immunization will help guide how that rollout works, what it looks like. And, you know, we don't have a vaccine that is approved yet. We will make sure that when we do have one that's approved by Health Canada and ready for rollout, we will utilize every opportunity. We've had Canadians' backs from day one, and that's not going to change. You know, sir, it surprises me every day when I think that the conservative.
Like, this is just murder. I can't even believe this, that we're 4 months out from this being delivered, and they send some guy out here who has no clue what he's not talking about.
Let's not get personal. I'd just say, guys, I'm going to have to unfortunately leave there, but Mr. Fisher, if your government could please tell us and clarify at any time, and we'll broadcast it immediately, why you say you don't know where Christine Elliott, the Ontario Health Minister, got those specific numbers, and the federal government doesn't know. If you could tell us where she got them or you're disputing them, please let us know. But I got to leave it there. Darren Fisher, Michelle Rempel, Garner, and Don Davies, I really appreciate that. Thank you so much. We got to take a short break, Adam. But I just want to say something to our viewers here, and I really appreciate the MPs. This is a passionate debate, and there's a lot of hope with the vaccine, but folks, you could see there's a heck of a lot of confusion out there. And I'm sure like you, you're like, wait a second, the federal government and the largest province have no idea who's saying what about when some of us could get the vaccine. All people. Really stunning. But coming up, Canada under threat. Are China, Russia, and Iran targeting Canada's electricity grid and our elections? The answer is yes, according to a new report from Canada's Cybersecurity Agency. We'll speak to the head of the Canadian Centre for Cybersecurity, Scott Jones, next with new details. Stay with Power Play. Welcome back to Power Play. Canada's critical infrastructure, our electricity grids, even our elections, are now under constant and increasing cyber attack from countries like China, Russia, Iran, North Korea. That's part of the headline from today's release of the National Cyber Threat Assessment from Canada's top cybersecurity agency, the CSE, the Communications Security Establishment. And these attacks are getting more sophisticated and more dangerous, and they're also targeting you. So, how do we protect ourselves from all these threats? Let's find out. The head of the Canadian Centre for Cybersecurity, Scott Jones, joins us. Always good to see you, sir. Let's just try to give people a sort of a 30,000-foot view. What are the most dangerous cyber threats to Canada, and what exactly could they do to us?
Well, thanks for having me. And I think one of the things we really wanted to emphasize, that the threat we all need to be facing is the threat of cybercrime. Whether you're a citizen, a small and medium business, or a large-scale organization in Canada, cyber criminals are targeting each and every one of us. And certainly the report then goes from there and does talk about other threats, the threats from the states, as you mentioned, but also the fact that the internet and the connectivity that we're seeing is embedded in pieces of our society that we simply, as individuals, are typically unaware of. And we need to start thinking about this now as this is our world, is the internet and cybersecurity. And the report is meant to say, we can do something about this. We can take action. We don't need to be scared, but we need to do something about it.
Okay, so I'm going to get to the action in a minute. A lot of folks think, okay, someone is attacking our electricity grid. We've all been subjected to phishing and cyber crimes and those scam calls. Let's just put that aside. Can you explain what the consequence could be about a cyber attack on an electricity grid? Like, what would that mean and who's doing that?
Well, absolutely. One of the things we did point out, that this has happened other places in the world, but we're not seeing that happen here. We say that it's highly unlikely, absent of international conflict, that anything would be directed at Canada. But we need to be prepared now for a threat we may face in the future. So what this could mean is technology is converging. And so things that used to sit independent and not be connected to the internet are now being connected. So the control systems for our electrical system, meaning whether or not the power lines are turned on or off, whether or not generators are turned on and turning or shut down and not generating electricity, or a dam is open or not. All of those are now controlled through operational technology, which is being connected to the internet and internet technology. And so that's one of the threats we said is you could conceivably turn off power. You could disrupt the flow of electricity. You could disrupt the flow of our water system as well. Critical infrastructure is interconnected, and it's things we depend on. So we need to be working on this, and we have been, but we need to continue to work on this together to address these threats before they become a real threat to Canada.
Right. I should point out, in your report, you talk about even Health Canada said there is ways that cyber attack can affect people's pacemakers, their diabetic medicine. So this stuff gets real sophisticated. You also talk in the report about the disinformation campaign that's trying to discredit Canadian politicians. Has that happened? Can you give us an example?
So we certainly have, and we've published other reports, the cyber threats to Canada's democratic process, for example, and then an update in 2017 and then an update in 2019, where we talked about misinformation, but also trying to influence, and we pointed out a couple examples targeting specific politicians. But it happens every day now. This is something where it's just constant misuse or misinformation on the internet, and this is where we're saying, look, we need to start turning to authoritative sources. In the context of the pandemic, we're saying, look to the public health agencies for your facts on COVID, for vaccine, and be cyber literate, knowing what's out there. The fact is, we can all write whatever we want on Twitter. We can all write whatever we want on social media platforms, any one of them. But go to the source. Look at what they're look at what's there. And if it's too good to be true, it probably is. And if it doesn't feel right, look for an authoritative source of information.
Well, it's interesting because you say they're trying to sow distrust these malevolent forces. You also write state-sponsored actors will almost certainly continue to conduct commercial espionage against Canadian businesses, academia, and governments to steal Canadian intellectual property and proprietary information. So our businesses are getting targeted.
Well, absolutely. And earlier this year, in the context of the pandemic, we saw Canadian vaccine providers targeted by, and we called out Russia, along with our allies in the United States and the United Kingdom for this, to say this is too far, saying you are targeting now a piece of critical infrastructure, but also something that's critical to our health. for that espionage and for that theft of information. And that's something where we are seeing that happen. It's something that's been happening for a number of years, where we have called it out, and this is something that we just have to say enough is enough.
Yeah.
And also work on strengthening ourselves against this type of activity.
Okay, so just last question. What do we do? So you've got Russia, China, North Korea, Iran. Those are state sponsors that you talk about that. And then there's all sorts of other actors. What do we do to stop this?
So this is actually one of those areas where we're making it easy for the actor. Basics matter in cybersecurity. And something as simple as updating our software, it can make a huge difference, and it makes us not vulnerable. Making sure we don't, as citizens, we don't reuse passwords, but that we secure the things we care about most, things like our banking information, etc. And we published things for small and medium organizations that say that gives simple instructions for those organizations that they can follow, things that are affordable for a small and medium organization that apply 80% of the benefit but with 20% of the cost. And then as citizens, if you have the option to turn on something called multi-factor authentication, that actually makes a big difference, and it makes it hard for cyber criminals. But those are basic things. And if people would like to see more tips, Get Cyber Safe is a great source for individual Canadians.
Yeah, Get Cyber Safe. You got to do it. It's coming, and it's coming fast, and it's sophisticated. Great to have you on the program, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right, before we head to break, some other news you need to know right now. The mayor of Vancouver says he's taking the first steps towards decriminalization of small amounts of any illicit drug in the city. Kennedy Stewart said he'll present a motion to City Council next Tuesday. If it passes, it then goes to the federal health and public safety ministers, as well as the attorney general. The mayor, Stewart, says the overdose crisis in Vancouver is deepening and the drugs need to be destigmatized so people can get help and not go to prison. In Ottawa today, NDP leader Jagmeet Singh said he supports the idea 100%.
The idea lies, we have to have a compassionate response, and a compassionate response to people dealing with addiction, people dealing with poverty, people dealing with mental health, is with health care, not by putting them in jail.
All right, the idea of decriminalizing simple drug possession, again, of any drug, already has the support of the BC Premier John Horgan and the province's chief medical health doctor, Dr. Bonnie Henry. If it passes, again, the federal government has to get involved. Vancouver would be the first Canadian city to decriminalize simple possession of any drug. Air Canada has yet to refund passengers for flights canceled due to COVID-19, but today the CEO told BNN Bloomberg's Amanda Lang that the airline would in fact be opening to providing refunds with a big caveat. Check out this exchange.
The minister has made it clear that refunds would be required, and based on the size and scale of the program, we have no issue, no quarrel with that at all. We've already refunded about $1.2 billion of refundable fares, and of course there's been a lot of pressure in terms of the non-refundable fares. And so we would definitely do that, assuming that the terms of the support package are adequate and that the terms are appropriate and reasonable.
Okay, you bail us out, you support us, maybe we'll do that. Keeping with air travel, though, the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration has finally cleared Boeing's 737 MAX to fly again with conditions after an order to ground the planes following two very deadly crashes. Remember, back in March of 2019, an Ethiopian Airlines flight that took off from Addis Ababa crashed, killing all 157 people on board. 5 months earlier, a Lion Air crash out of Jakarta, Indonesia, killed all 189 people on board. The FAA and Boeing say the faulty sensor that pushed the aircraft's nose downward in flight has been corrected. Now, what about Canada? Well, Canada's Transport Minister Mark Garneau says Canada's still working towards a safe return of the aircraft and will not directly follow the FAA. In other words, Canada may have even tougher rules. The House of Commons, by the way, has voted to force a government response on Huawei's involvement in Canada's 5G network within 30 days. Opposition parties plus five Liberal MPs banded together today, voting in support of a Conservative motion to have the government announce a decision on Huawei's participation in the rollout. Canada is, by the way, the only Five Eyes member, that's the intelligence sharing circle, Australia, New Zealand, the UK, Canada, and the US, who have not already banned the Chinese-backed tech company. The motion also calls on Ottawa to unveil a plan to stop Chinese state interference on Canadian soil. And we just talked about that. Finally, Pfizer offers up a light at the end of the coronavirus tunnel, but is Canada ready to distribute the vaccine? And again, going back to what we just spoke about, why the disconnect between the biggest province and the federal government over who gets that vaccine and when? That's next. Stay with us. Welcome back to the program. Look, some very positive updates on the vaccine front in Canada today, and then some very serious mixed messages. Let's start positive. Pfizer says they've got new test results. It shows that the coronavirus vaccine that has yet to be approved, but they said it will be, has a 95% effective rate, although it needs to be stored at minus 75 degrees Celsius. That could and will complicate distribution. But heck, distribution's a better problem to have than access, and Canada's got it. But then Ontario announced that Canada will get 6 million doses of vaccine, 4 million of those Pfizer vaccines and 2 million of Moderna. Really specific details today from Ontario's Health Minister, Christine Elliott. And then the federal government wouldn't confirm those. And then on this program, the federal government questioned where Ontario got those numbers. Why the confusion? What does that tell us? Let's bring in the press gallery. Stephanie Levitz is a reporter with the Canadian Press. Robert Benzie is the Toronto Star's Queen's Park Bureau Chief. Our special guest is our friend Dr. Kwadjo Karamenting, an ICU and palliative care physician. Great to have you here. Benz, I'm going to start with you because you're our Queen's Park guy. Let me just show you this exchange I just had with the Parliamentary Secretary of Health, Darren Fisher, just minutes ago on this program where he questions the Health Minister of Ontario. Check this out. Is Christine Elliott wrong then? Or is that what the federal government's saying? You don't stand by her numbers. We should not believe the Health Minister of Ontario?
I'm not aware of where she got her numbers. I'm not sure what provinces have for possible numbers that might come forward depending on which contract yields a successful and approved by Health Canada that is safe for Canadians vaccine.
Okay, yeah, okay. Robert Benzie, I was a bit stunned. What do you make of that? That he's not aware of where Ontario's got its numbers on, like, the most important thing, by the way, that the federal government procured.
Yeah, Evan, I was watching that exchange and I checked with senior officials in the Ontario government about the numbers that Christine Elliott cited in the legislature today under questioning from a Liberal MPP, actually, who is trying to trip up the Conservative government at Queen's Park on vaccine plans. And Christine Elliott's numbers, I'm told, are accurate. It's 4 million for Canada in January and February, not March, as some of the opposition, federal opposition politicians were saying earlier on the show. But so that's the first 2 months of the new year, 4 million of the Pfizer for all of Canada and 2 million of the Moderna for all of Canada. And Ontario would get 40% of those doses.
Yeah, she was really specific, Steph Levitz. The federal government was cagey about it. And now, as I guess the parliamentary secretary to the health minister has said, the federal government is unaware of how Ontario is so specific about those numbers. What does that tell you, Steph?
It tells me a couple of things, and let's break it out, right? The Ford government is currently getting a lot, and I mean a lot, of pushback about how they're currently managing the pandemic, the coming in and out of restriction zones. Lecce, the education minister, doing an apparent backflip on whether the schools are being closed. The Ontario government needs to look like it has its house in order. And so if they have those numbers, they're going to go with them because it means that, you know, they can say, hey, we are ready. Here is a fact. The federal government, by contrast, has a political problem, right? They don't want to be looking at playing favorites among the provincial children. You know, I think we've discussed on this program before and elsewhere that they need to be a lot more transparent about how they're making these decisions. And they haven't yet done that. They've only talked about, we're working on a rollout system. We're talking about how this goes. The fact that Darren Fisher didn't have the numbers on his fingertips suggests that they're not ready to be making that declaration. And that's pretty problematic because if you have the provinces out and at the end of the day, it's going to be them administering that vaccine, the federal government better play catch up. And, you know, as a lot of people have been saying, the federal government isn't showing a lot of national leadership on this question. And perhaps that exchange you just had with Mr. Fisher is another example of that problem.
Let's go right to the front lines, Dr. Karamenting. Look, in the end, it's going to be people like you that are distributing this. And there are some logistical challenges in terms of storage. There's ethical in terms of who gets it first. But I mean, just for, are you getting any information about a vaccine rollout on the front line, sir? Because it seems like the federal government and the big provinces they're not communicating on this.
Yeah, we're definitely not getting any feedback in terms of what a rollout plan would be. I know certainly we have a lot of opinions on where the vaccine should be focused, and it, you know, in my humble opinion, it's the problem areas. So, you know, we're going to have to see how efficacious it is on our older patients, but long-term care, where like it's been hit hard, like 80% of our deaths have been through long-term care or nursing homes. And, you know, I always often think about low socioeconomic, racialized communities where it's also been hit the hardest. So, and then obviously frontline staff, like to be able to stay protected and avoid spreading it to, you know, our patients. So a lot of thought goes into that, but definitely we haven't heard about a clear plan.
No, and then, Benz, let me just go back to you. I mean, when frontline workers, I mean, Dr. Caramente is working in you know, palliative care, in ICUs. They've got to know this. We could be a month or two away from this. Do we need a national rollout strategy, Benz?
Yeah, I think we do, Evan. I don't think, even though the provinces deliver healthcare and even though the provinces do their own vaccination programs here in Ontario, the flu vaccination program this year is the largest in provincial history. 5.5 million doses or so have been purchased, which is about 10% more than they usually order each year. Even though provinces deliver healthcare, I think you do need, on something like this that's going to be worldwide demand, you do need a national strategy, and you do have to have a national rollout. And Roger's right. You have to, it has to be targeted at the most vulnerable, not, you know, I don't need it. I don't need to be first in line. You know, journalists maybe don't need to be first in line, but certainly older folks, people in racialized communities who are in congregate living settings, people in long-term care and so on, they should be at the front of the line.
Don't you understand that this panel is also called Quadjo's Right? That's how Dr. Caramente rules, okay? Guys, hey, just hang on a second. Let me just take a break here. Stand by. I want to pick up this discussion, but Alberta's live right now, and the officials there are, and that province is having a really tough time. They've got an update on COVID-19. Let's go there, and we'll return to the press gallery.
Hospital space is available to patients with COVID if they reduce the number of other patients in hospital. This means reducing the amount of scheduled or elective surgeries and other procedures that might require overnight stays in hospital and reducing the number of ambulatory clinic visits. AHS also has contingency plans in place to ensure beds are available if needed to provide care for patients with COVID-19. Hospital sites are increasing spaces that may be required for COVID-19 patients by opening units not currently in operation and equipping and maximizing other spaces in a safe manner. As part of its surge capacity planning, AHS is also increasing ICU capacity across the province. AHS has the ability to create temporary ICU space in spaces that would otherwise be used to care for patients who have other conditions requiring specialized care, such as cardiac units, post-operative recovery areas, and other areas able to support ventilators and cardiac monitoring. In short, AHS is preparing and working hard to meet demands. But there are consequences to these measures in delayed access to non-COVID care, and there is a ceiling to capacity expansion. We need Albertans to do their part. By working together to reduce the spread of COVID-19 in the community, we can reduce the need for hospitalization and demands on our hospitals and emergency departments. Turning to schools, there are currently active alerts or outbreaks in 320 schools, about 13% of all schools in Alberta. This number includes 64 schools that are currently on the watch list. So far, in-school transmission has likely occurred in 157 schools. Of these, about 83 had only one new case as a result. Sadly, I must report 11 new deaths over the past 24 hours. My condolences go out to the loved ones and friends who are mourning every one of these lost lives, not just today, but since the pandemic began. We have lost Albertans to other causes in this time as well, and they are also mourned and missed. But the difference is that we did not have the collective power to prevent all those other deaths. With COVID-19, we do have that power. Almost a quarter of all our COVID-19 deaths have happened since November 1st. If we do not change our trajectory, the implications are grim. The daily COVID-19 death count is a tragic reminder that COVID-19 is not just a flu. It is life and death. And often it is the outcome of choices made by Albertans who may not even know the victims. Almost one in three cases are getting sick from sources we can't identify. We know that overall, as of November 15th, about 40% of cases are linked to a household or social gathering or private event. 10% are linked to continuing care, 4% to childcare or K-12 schools, and 3% to acute care outbreaks. But for 30%, the source remains unknown. Over the last few weeks, and as we have faced challenges in achieving timely contact tracing, that number is also rising. Every day, about 250 to 350 people are getting sick, and we have been unable to identify the source of transmission. This puts us all at greater risk. This is why we put in place the measures we did last week. The measures are focused on settings where there is the highest risk of one case spreading to many if there is a slip in public health measures. I am disappointed at reports of organizations and businesses that are trying to find loopholes in the order and are continuing activities. I have seen examples of fitness studios running group classes with a video rather than an instructor. Some team sport practices have continued by moving to a neighboring community's rink, and some teams continue to socialize together simply because they're in a cohort as a team. I recognize that many groups have done incredible work to go above and beyond the measures in place. I want to thank all groups and individuals who have made that effort. Other teams or businesses may feel as if they are doing nothing wrong. Let me be clear. The intent of these measures is to facilitate a two-week hard stop of all activity that can provide opportunity for large-scale COVID spread. I have heard people say that while we have communicated this is just for 2 weeks, they believe it will last longer, so they don't want to comply. We cannot create a self-fulfilling prophecy. Any individual, group, or business that chooses to continue is putting at risk the time-limited nature of these restrictions. These actions risk not just further restrictions on their own businesses and activities, but further restrictions for all those who are choosing to comply and going above and beyond as well. This is deadly serious. I have asked for kindness, but I also ask for firmness. The need to control our spread and protect our health system is why I ask everyone anywhere in the province to abide by all public health measures. As individuals, I can't emphasize enough how important it is to stay home and get tested if you have symptoms. Albertans cannot write off symptoms as just a cold. What is a mild illness to many is deadly to some. Albertans cannot avoid testing because it's inconvenient or because they don't want to get their party host in trouble. They cannot fear that a positive result will make them unpopular with their friends. We need to view every gas pump, every walk through a mall, every pass through a store door, every stair railing or escalator as an opportunity to prevent COVID spread. With unknown transmission sources at current levels, there are cases that we still don't know about. Every one that spreads is a threat to the health of others. Everyone that spreads is a threat to the healthcare system. Everyone that spreads means the potential for more intrusive measures in the future. My sincere thanks go to the many, many Albertans, most Albertans, who are washing hands, staying distant from those outside their household, wearing masks, keeping their cohorts small, and respecting the measures in place in their communities. My heartfelt thanks and appreciation go out to the healthcare workers who are working heroically to ensure our healthcare system has the capacity to meet the demands of rising hospitalization and ICU numbers. My thanks and encouragement go to all individuals working in COVID assessment centers and the lab who are helping us stay on top of the need and demand for rapid testing. And special thanks go to the contact tracers who are working to address the backlog of contact tracing work that will help us increase our understanding about sources of transmission. Alberta, we can still bend the curve. If we work together, if we live by the same rules, if we take the same precautions, if we believe in a common goal, we can slow the spread. In fact, coming together is the only way we can. Thank you, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Dr. Hinshaw.
And that is Dr. Hinshaw. That was a quiet fury from the public health official, Dr. Hinshaw, in Alberta, as cases there are spiking, furious that people are taking advantage of it and urging people passionately to follow the directives. All right, I'm going to bring back the press gallery. Rob Benzie is here, Steph Levitz is here, and Dr. Kara Manting's back. Lots to pick up on the disconnect between Ontario and the federal government on the vaccine rollout and other restrictions. But just, I want to follow up on Alberta there, Dr. Kara Manting. Man, Dr. Hinshaw, who's very calm usually, was angry. I think things are spinning out of control a bit in Alberta, among other places. Is there a sense now that people, that you guys are just, you know, the medical community is on the edge now, and if we don't take drastic action, things are going to get real bad?
Yeah, I think the thing with COVID is it's very, like, your approach has to be regionalized. Like, when I look at our situation in Ottawa, for example, we're doing very well. Like, we're in a government town. 70% of people work for the government. They're able to stay home. People have been quite compliant in terms of distancing, keeping their social gatherings small, you know. And, like, for example, I think in the city right now, I think there's maybe four ICU cases of COVID. And so, you know what, you got to speak to your people. Like, are your people being compliant? Is your system being overrun? And, right, you know, I think the situation in Alberta, like, it's always hard when you're not there, but from the sounds of Dr. Hinshaw, like, system is on the verge of being overrun. And so you need to make a change. And so I like the way she's speaking in terms of focusing on high yields areas, so reducing social gathering, right, limited time for like 2 weeks, basic measures like hand washing and masking. But I mean, they're in a spot where people need to step up. And I hope, you know, I'm from Alberta originally, yeah, so I'm thinking of my family and all the people out there. And I would echo what Dr. Hinshaw said. You could do it if we comply, you know. It's tough.
So let me just quickly, in the last couple of minutes I've got, Steph, I'm going to quickly go to you. Sources have told CTV News that restrictions on non-essential travel between the U.S. and Canada, the border, are going to be in place for another month. No surprise there. There's a fire burn, a COVID fire. But CBSA reported that since March, there have been, you know, over 6.5 million crossings, 50% of those, 5.3 million travelers, most of them essential workers, 50% of them truckers. Thank you to the truckers. Hats off to the truckers. They've been doing it. They're keeping us alive, believe me. But 80% of the folks traveling across the border don't quarantine, and there's been very little tracking, so there's no tracing. Is that a big lapse in the system, Steph?
The tracking part definitely has to be considered a lapse. I mean, let's again, you know, go all the way back to the beginning of this crisis, when the answer at the time was, how are we going to contain this? Well, we need robust testing, and we need robust contact tracing. And so it's one thing to declare people not essential labor, saying they don't have to quarantine. There's good reasons for that in some cases, but to not track them, to not get a sense of whether they've had COVID, whether they've brought in COVID. You know, when you listen to Dr. Hinshaw talking about how they can't identify where cases are coming from, you know, and then we have this entire population that's moving back, yeah, and forth across the border. And that's what makes this Calgary pilot project, where they're going to be testing folks, those, yeah, rapid tests, semi-rapid anyway. You know, there's a lot of folks now saying, and maybe the doctor, you know, has thoughts on this too, the only way through this now is mass testing as well. We can't just wait for a vaccine. We have to dramatically ramp up testing. And maybe those essential workers coming across, right, the border have to be part of that test.
I got a 30-second haiku for you, Ben. Do you want to weigh in on whether they should have been contact tracing at the border?
Yeah, I mean, they should have. And Steph's right. We need the rapid test, the semi-rapid test. It's not as rapid as it should be, but we need that everywhere. It's just a pilot in Alberta. We need it in Ontario. People are still landing at Pearson International Airport, not super far from where I am right now. And we have to, it's an honor system to quarantine, you know?
Yeah. Guys, unfortunately, I got to leave it there. Dr. Caramenting, great to have you on. Robert Benzie, who always wins our Shelfie Award for the best looking bookshelf on television. And Steph Levitz, great to have you here. And thank all of you for watching. Thank all of you for engaging in our democracy. We'll be back here in 23 short hours. As I always say, hug your loved ones if it's safe. Have a great evening. We'll see you tomorrow.